A Star is Born is a story that's been told on screen three times. Janet Gaynor, Judy Garland, and Barbara Streisand all played the up-and-comer who falls in love with the established artist, only to watch him fall as she rises.
Now, Lady Gaga stars opposite Bradley Cooper in the latest telling of the story. It's also Cooper's directing debut, with the rest of the cast including Sam Elliott, Andrew Dice Clay, and Dave Chappelle. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We'll break down the singing, the glamour, the tears, and the wonder of Sam Elliott's voice. We're talking about A Star is Born on today's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Here with me and Stephen in the studio is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And in our fourth chair, we could not be more thrilled to welcome our friend who's been gone way too long, who we knew had to be there for this, all things considered host Ari Shapiro. Hi, Ari.
Hi, Linda.
We knew. Gotta go get Ari. Gotta go get Ari. Now, I saw this, and Glenn saw this, back in Toronto a few weeks ago. Ari and Stephen are coming to it a little more recently, I believe. I have written a review of it, so I'm going to run down what Glenn thinks, and then I'm going to go to Ari and Stephen. Glenn, what is your position on A Star is Born?
Sure, I liked it. I mean, it's melodrama, and that's not a dig. As you point out in your very excellent review, melodrama is just a genre, which means it traffics in heightened emotions to get some kind of response in the viewer. It does that when Gaga comes out on stage at that moment that we just heard. I'm not a monster. I'm not a robot. There was a deep emotional response. We know this story, and he does really smart things, I think, to freshen it up. I think that stuff works a lot better in the first half than the second half, but we can talk more about it.
All right. How about you, Ari?
I want to point out one thing that I think the movie did brilliantly and one thing that I found so absurd it was laughable. The way this film captures the highs and lows of going from on stage and being adored by thousands to being off stage and being in the dark by yourself, the emotional crash that that brings, and the need to fill that crash with something like alcohol, I totally recognized from my own experience. I tour with a band called Pink Martini, and when your 9-to-5 job is singing in front of an adoring audience of thousands, that adjustment is shocking and hard, and the juxtaposition between the dark, grotty backstage and the bright lights on stage can be difficult for the most resilient, emotional, psychological person.
Yeah, I really like the sound design, too. When he gets into the SUV and he closes the door, you get that muffled crowd noise, but you can tell that he also is just, now he's going into a different mode, even though there's a crowd out there still
cheering.
Go ahead.
And the thing that I found laughably absurd was the idea that the two of them have a late night moment in a parking lot where she hums out a couple chords, and the next thing you know, the two of them are on stage with the perfect accompaniment. They know how to get into the bridge. They know how to break it down.
Yes.
I mean, it was, as Glenn said, a glorious moment, but also laughably absurd.
That's the heightened fantasy portion. I would agree with that. What do you think, Stephen?
Well, I come at this from the same perspective as Ari. I, too, am a touring superstar. I had some of the same issues with the kind of two halves of this movie. I think the first half of this movie is about discovery and connection and creativity and the exhilaration of performance. And the second half of the movie is about the consequences of that. And you have to tell that story. You can't, I mean, first of all, obviously they're working with this source material, but you also don't want to tell the story they tell in the first half of this movie without delving into the sometimes severe consequences of particularly his actions in the beginning of this film. But I think that Bradley Cooper directs this movie with so much more enthusiasm in the first half than in the second. The first half, especially those musical performances, are so incredibly exhilarating. But as the movie goes along and she's bearing the weight of artistic compromise, he is bearing the weight of substance abuse, the performances flatten. And in a way, the intensity of the feeling that I was having while watching this movie kind of waned and waned over the course of the film. On balance, I really liked it.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, one of the things that I like about it, I think that they managed to make him really regrettable in his behavior in a lot of places, but you still understand that he genuinely loves her and wants to help her. It's not just I want to see myself reflected in your glory or whatever. I think that initial scene where they are in that parking lot, I think is really effective in building that relationship between them. And I like how kind of wary she is. She knows he's really famous, but she also has a lot of, like, you clearly drink too much, yeah. you clearly are in trouble, but they have that sort of intoxicating opening meeting that draws them closer together. The place where I would stick up for the second half of the movie, I guess, from my own perspective, is I think she does begin to carry it more. She's grounding the second half of the movie with kind of her more understandable and more quote-unquote normal behavior. I do want to talk a little bit about what it is saying. You talked about artistic compromise, and I was curious because at the beginning of this movie, what Jackson Maine, which you couldn't have just called him John.
What did you say it should be in your review?
Rugged Q Desperado.
There we go.
But what he's doing at the beginning, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Stephen, to me, what he was doing at the beginning is what you have described as hunga dunga dang
sure.
kind of singing. So I didn't necessarily know that he was doing some towering thing before. And then she kind of sells everything out because there's a moment where she does a song about clearly you're supposed to interpret as kind of like a somewhat trashy song, although it's kind of a banger, right?
A song about how good a boy looks in his jeans, which I would argue is a valid subject of art.
Yes, but it is such a beautifully terrible song.
Yeah.
And you know that Gaga took such joy in writing the worst, trashiest pop song she mm-hmm. possibly could.
And when I say it's sort of a banger, what I mean by that is only that, like, I don't know that it's not art. It's just kind of...
Well, it's not her. It's not the her that we have seen
right.
as the film has...
But like, what's wrong with pop? Like, is it an anti-pop
right.
music song?
I think from his perspective, that's true. I mean, I think you're seeing kind of two things happen at the same time. You're seeing him resenting her for becoming a pop star and also seeing her kind of floating farther and farther away from him. And I think part of what draws her to him musically is this sense that he has of her authenticity, and he feels like her authenticity is being drained away. I feel like you're not necessarily supposed to think, oh, she used to be good and now she's bad.
Yeah, but I do think this film buys into Jackson Maine's, the character's, authenticity BS. And I understand one thing. I understand that country music, and this isn't country music specifically, is more rootsy, right? What would
I would
call
say
it?
I would call it Americana. It's not necessarily Hunga Dunga Dang, which is more like Nickelback.
But the first song that you see him singing is. Go ahead. But you're the inventor of Hunga Dunga Dang, so if you say it's not.
So when you see a dude in a cowboy hat doing country-adjacent, country-inflected music that espouses the notion, maybe it's time to let the old ways die, and then later sings, I don't want to go back to where I'm from. These are not country thoughts. These are not traditional. I mean, I know it's a lot wider. Willie Nelson, Musgraves, I know things have changed. But then to turn around and have him dump on a song about how good somebody looks in their jeans is just, it just feels...
There are plenty of country songs about basically the same idea.
If you listen to country radio right now, roughly 75% of the songs are about how good women look in various pant and short wear.
Short wear. Culottes.
Bloomers.
Knickers. What I find so interesting about the music is that Gaga has created an identity as a pop star, as somebody who continually reinvents herself, and this idea of core authenticity has never been what she, as a pop star, is about. So on the one hand, you have her playing this character who, over the course of the movie, discovers the value of actually being her authentic pop star self, played by this person who has never valued that kind of identity, who, as a writer, is creating songs that fall into a dozen different genres over the course of this film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, in a very good, very difficult to write, I imagined, Taffy Brodesser-Ackner profile in the New York Times Magazine of Bradley Cooper, one of the few things she could get him to say, because he really resented having to be in the profile at all, one of the chief things he wanted to do was to make this movie so that the dude is not jealous of her, but is just disappointed in her, which I would argue is just as paternalistic.
Yeah.
Well, and the funny thing is, I did not go back and watch all of the previous versions all the way through, but I have seen some of them enough to kind of get a feel for them. And one of the things that I realized was in all of these versions, there's a little bit of ambiguity. And I said this in the review, too. There's a little bit of ambiguity between is he upset because and is he in agony because he is a drag on her? Because there is definitely a suggestion of that. And
yeah.
I think that's more suggested maybe in this one than any of them.
It's certainly what her manager thinks.
But is it that he feels bad because he's a drag on her, or is it because he is resentful that she has surpassed him? And I think that ambiguity is valuable. I think it's okay to kind of leave that way. I think if he intended to remove that element of resentment, that's probably a mistake, because I think it over-sentimentalizes, if I can say it that way, the story, and it takes some of the interesting tension out of it to sort of insist that he doesn't feel eclipsed by her and doesn't feel threatened by her.
I feel like he makes that text subtext. I certainly felt on some level that he was jealous, even though it's not necessarily stated.
Yeah, but from the very beginning, the first time they meet, he has this narrative of you have to be true to what you have to say.
Right.
And that's the through line of the movie. Mm-hmm. And that's when she has this first pop song with this ridiculous hair and these ridiculous lyrics that he's able to, on the surface level, object to without saying, I'm angry that you're becoming more popular than I am.
Right.
Yeah, I think what we might be kind of feeling around is Bradley Cooper's direction, not the performance, but his direction, because he knew that this infrastructure of the story is very fixed. So what he did was he allowed the actors to improvise throughout. And it feels that these scenes, especially in the beginning, these scenes feel innovative, and he's bringing something new to the story, not just drag queens, although the drag queens are important. That's how you invoke the ghost of Judy Garland. You bring some drag queens in.
Well, that and having her sing the opening bars to Somewhere Over the Rainbow in the first scene we meet her.
So there is that, and Lillian Rose. It's a lot. Let me just say it's a lot. It's all good. But it answered some questions and left others hanging. For example, he comes on screen, and you're like, why is he doing Sam Elliott? Why is he doing Sam Elliott? And then Sam Elliott shows up, and you're like, that doesn't make it less weird. That makes it more weird.
But then, to me, they get there.
Then they get there in a way that I don't have the script in front of me, but I am sure was something that was discovered in the moment, and then they said, we're gonna run with that. A lot of those moments, a lot of overlapping dialogue. He talks a lot about influences. Certainly Altman is in there because of all that overlapping dialogue. So I like that if we're going to be on rails, we at least get all these specific moments scattered throughout.
Can I just share a funny drag queen story?
Of course. Oh, always.
A couple years ago, I was at a friend's wedding, and Willem, the drag queen from RuPaul's Drag Race, who is in this film, was at the wedding. And Willem's in-person identity is very similar to Willem's drag identity, which is to say, a bit flighty, bit amusing, bit all over the place. And during this wedding, Willem was very excited because, as he told us, he had just been cast in a remake of A Star is Born starring Lady Gaga. And all of us at the wedding were sort of like, sure you were. Okay, Willem, whatever you say. So yeah. I sit in this darkened theater 2 years later, having totally forgotten that conversation, and who pops on the screen but Willem?
Yeah.
It was pretty good. Pretty good.
Yeah, it's interesting to me, too, because I think the moment in which you see, and Ari mentioned, her sort of singing Lovey and Rose in a drag bar, that was the moment where I kind of thought, look, the people who have made this film, Bradley Cooper or whoever else was involved, understand that part of the appeal of this is that crowd that wants Lady Gaga as Judy Garland, as Edith Piaf, as every kind of torchy diva, and wants to see that moment. And so you get a lot of it. You get that full performance of Lovey and Rose, where she's kind of, and I think the idea that she's kind of a guest among the drag queens is a very interesting way to introduce her.
Yeah. I do think Lady Gaga is particularly great in this movie.
I think she is too.
I think her performance, she's doing not only a lot of expression and a lot of singing and pulling off these performances that we are shown are great instead of merely being told are great. It's so important that they cast a tremendous performer like a Judy Garland, like a Barbara Streisand, in a role like that. So she pulls off all of that, but she also does an amazing amount of acting with her eyes, acting with her face. You see when she meets him, this mix of hesitation about what are his obvious drawbacks and the not opportunities from a career opportunity standpoint, but just an opportunity to do different things in her life. You see all of that on her face in this performance. I really think she is fantastic.
Specifically, her ability to capture the feeling of the terrifying first time on stage, getting an audience's love
that
after
so good.
She, as a performer, has been doing stadium shows and the Super Bowl for years. Mm-hmm. She is so in that moment of fear and elation and terror and excitement. I was amazed at her acting ability because for her, this is punching the clock. This is what she does every day.
Right. Well, and I also really appreciated the fact that that first time that you see her in that performance of Shallow that everybody has seen in the trailer 400 times, that performance, it's not like we didn't already have plenty of ways to know that Lady Gaga is legitimately a great musician and a great vocalist and a great songwriter. But when you see her in that performance, it's really just singing at a microphone. It doesn't have all of the accoutrement that she brings to many of her performances. It doesn't have her in an egg, in a giant whatever. It's really just her singing. And I really appreciated the fact that they are so happy to put that focus on her. And I agree. I think she's great. I also think Bradley Cooper has a, you know, it's so common to praise actors for a lack of vanity every time that they don't look great all the time. Mm-hmm. But it's not just the lack of vanity from a, this is not the most flattering shooting of him that I've ever seen, which I liked. He looks very leathery and really? Kind yeah. of sweaty. And I heard somebody say somewhere like that face of what.
He looks sunblasted.
And kind of what alcohol often does to yeah. kind of yeah. the way people's faces look. But also the fact that, like, there's a part where they're sort of about to make out and he's super drunk and you just, there's this moment where as they started to kiss, I was like, ugh.
Yeah, you know he smells.
Yeah, yeah.
He smells like a man who has never stopped drinking.
It's like, that wouldn't be fun. And it's Bradley Cooper. I've always thought he was an attractive man, but like you look at it and you're like, ugh, that would yeah. be gross. I bet that's super gross. And it kind of is played out in that scene. Mm-hmm. It's true to that, yeah. I think.
There's also some lovely supporting performances in this movie. I mean, they give Sam Elliott, I think, more to do than Sam Elliott is sometimes given to do. Mm-hmm. You have Anthony Ramos from Hamilton pops
yeah.
up, which was, I was watching the movie with our producer, Jessica Reedy, and I like elbowed her, like, you know, because yeah. there are other people from Hamilton you see pop up in movies. I hadn't seen him
He's
yet.
He's popping up more.
I don't think I'd ever seen Dave Chappelle play that sincere.
Yes.
I thought that was a very nice performance.
Yeah, I mean, it's very brief, but yeah, it's a pretty straightforward performance from him. I didn't personally need to see Andrew Dice Clay, but that's more the mood that I'm in. but I think, yeah, I would watch a lot of buddy movies with Lady Gaga and Anthony Ramos, I think. I think that was fun.
I think whether because of addiction or something else, a lot of us have either experienced or seen the challenge of loving a person when it's really hard and the temptation to say, I don't need this in my life anymore, and the struggle to stay with it in spite of that. In this case, it was addiction. It can also be mental health. It can be any number of things. I thought that depiction was really beautiful and accurate.
Yeah, I think it's a very touching movie. And again, nothing wrong with melodrama, nothing wrong with something that's just pulling on you and saying, give us a cry, give us a cry. I went back to my notes and they said Goosies, which is, thank you, Jennifer Lopez, for that description of Goosebumps. Anyway, come and tell us what you thought of A Star is Born. I know a lot of you are excited to see it. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, you know it. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Adult Swim. The only way the president can save Washington, D.C. is to nuke it. And if you think that doesn't make sense, you don't know President Phil Ken Sebin. Now, the only way to free the president from himself, to save the country from annihilation, and to liberate the world from a power-hungry dictator is to impeach President Phil Ken Sebin. The man for this job is a Birdman. Harvey Birdman is back for a special case. Harvey Birdman, Attorney General, October 14th at midnight, only on Adult Swim. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Madewell, where the motto is good days start with great jeans. Madewell has options for every type of denim devotee, men's and women's styles, extended sizes, and more. And you can recycle any brand of old jeans in Madewell stores. Madewell works with Blue Jeans Go Green to turn them into housing insulation for communities in need. For every pair you bring in, you'll get $20 off a new one. So stop by a Madewell store or go to madewell.com.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Steven C. Boom Boom Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
No. I'm just going to roll with it. A couple of years ago, I put together a Spotify playlist called Songs for Editing. And I probably get asked about this more than anything I've ever done. People will tweet me at random, can you send me the link to this playlist where you put together a whole bunch of ambient music that will fill your head with attractive noise while you're trying to work. And people ask me for it all the time, but I personally feel like that playlist has gotten really unwieldy. And so this week I've put together a streamlined greatest hits mega mix called Thinkin' Songs with about 2 hours of my favorite pieces of this kind of head-filling music so that you can hunker down and hopefully discover some of your new favorite artists in this genre.
Does this mean no words? Does this mean stuff that fades into the background?
There's almost no words. There are a couple of songs that have words you can't quite make out, or there's one song with a few samples. It's a mix of different stuff. There's some beautiful kind of, with this wonderful guitarist named Nathan Salzberg. There are these kind of grand choral works by this woman named Juliana Barwick. There's a band from Austin called The Calm Blue Sea that makes these big, boomy, stormy kind of rock songs. Those are mostly instrumental. And then your kind of Max Richter, Stars of the Lid, a lot of these kind of pieces that feel like movie scores and are sometimes used as movie scores. It's a bunch of really beautiful music that I'm always excited to listen to, and I'm really excited to share it with people. It's about 2 hours long, so it's a little bit more digestible. You're not listening to entire albums that you may or may not like the way that Songs for Editing playlist is set up. So anyway, we will throw up a link. It is called Thinkin' Songs, coming out this week.
Thinkin' Songs. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Tea with the Dames.
Oh, yeah.
Is a ladyfinger of a film, a crustless finger sandwich of a film, starring Dame Maggie Smith, Dame Judi Dench, Dame Joan Plowright, and Dame Eileen Atkins. They gather together at Plowright's country estate, and they don't have tea. The title is a lie. They sip decorously from water for the entire time, and they just talk, and so it's really disappointing. It would be a much better film if they actually had some tea, or maybe some bourbon in the tea. I don't know, but like, they just sit around, they talk about their careers and the stage and acting in film and handsy actors and cruel directors, and it's the quintessence. It is the distillation of what I want from a film called Tea with the Dames. It is only in select cities, as they say, and I'm assured it is going to be going wider, as it very much should, because it's a delight of just exactly what you want when you go into a film with these four broads in it.
Do they name names?
They do name names, but again, it's like, oh, this actor from like 1950s Britain.
Rudolph Valentino.
Yeah. Take that. Miles Mulbridge, whatever the hell your name is. It's like, yeah.
Speaking of delights and things that are exactly what you would want them to be, Glenn has a review of this film up at npr.org, and you can read about how he sets up a taxonomy, as he does, of which dame you are, and how the four dames are just like the four women on Girls or on the Golden Girls or anything like that. You can figure out which dame you are, and I highly recommend that review as well. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Ari Shapiro, what is making you happy this week, sir?
You know, I came in here planning to talk about Sally Field's memoir, which is literary and thoughtful and insightful and worth reading. And then last night I discovered that while I was off the grid with my phone turned off for the last 7 days, Robin released a new single.
Yeah, she did.
And for those who don't know, Robin, R-O-B-Y-N, the Swedish pop star, performed the kind of incredible feat of, as the New York Times put it in a profile, taking her 30s off from pop music. In about 2010, she released these three LPs called Body Talk Volumes 1, 2, and 3, and they were huge. They got huger when Lena Dunham used one of the songs, Dancing on My Own, in Girls. And somehow, even though Robin has been relatively absent from the pop scene for most of the last decade, she has become more popular in the interim. She's done a couple collaborations here and there with Royksopp. Every now and then she'll make an appearance doing a DJ set or something like that. But she now has a new album on the way. Earlier this summer, the first single from that album called Missing You was released. The title track from the album, called Honey, is the new single. And for somebody like me who has been literally wearing out Body Talk, if it were possible to do such a thing in digital music, this prospect of 9 new tracks from Robin herself that sound as good as at least these first two do gives me, as you said, Linda, goosies.
Oh, nice. Wonderful. Thank you very much, Ari Shapiro. So what is making me happy this week is a tweet thread that I started last week where I asked people to tell me about their favorite bookstore. And I have over 1,000 responses to this now. And people told me about big bookstores, small bookstores, places in the United States, places around the world. Some are used bookstores. Some are new bookstores. Some are a mix of both. It was a tremendous pleasure to hear people call out the places that they love to go for books. And I wondered secretly whether if I left this thread going long enough, somebody would get to Lobster Lane Books, which is a tiny little bookstore in South Thomaston, Maine, that I used to go to when I was a teenager and my family was on vacation, which I love so much that it is actually fictionalized in my upcoming novel. Aww. So somebody did eventually mention Lobster Lane Books, which made me so happy. So if you want to see a lot of people talking about how much they love books and what it is that they love about their bookstores and the people who help them find the things that they love to read, you can find that tweet thread. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. And that is a great thread that made me very, 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 very happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at Linda Holmes. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon. And you can follow Ari Shapiro at Ari Shapiro.
Just like that.
I know, right? You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer, Vincent Accavino, at V. Accavino. You can find our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music that you are tapping your foot to right now. Thank you so much to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
It's been a joy.
And thanks to all of you for listening. We will see you right back here next week.
Hey, it's Jesse from Bullseye. Jack Black and Kyle Gass are back as Tenacious D, mature, sophisticated masters at the peak of their craft.
Feels like we're, hey, you know what? It feels like we're finally grown up.
Yeah, grossed up.
We're finally all grossed up, Cage.
New episodes every Monday on Bullseye.